You're listening to the inner monologue of Dim Tillard.
Who? Never heard of him.
Who's this guy?
I ain't nobody.
Now here is Dim Tillard.
Greetings and salutations.
You are listening to the number one most unneeded podcast on the entire planet, the inner monologue of Dim Tillard podcast. And I am the proprietor of this establishment, Tim Dillard. Who am I, may you ask? No, you may not ask, but I'll tell you anyway. I've been a pitcher in professional baseball for over 17 years, and I have a computer, which means I'm now ultra qualified to create my own podcast, and I'm already on my 10th episode. That's right.
The number of the day is 10.
A 10.
And it's unusual, but I'm really excited about this episode. So before you stop listening, just let me say this. Don't stop listening, because it's time for our first segment.
And here we go.
Since the beginning of time, telephones have been receiving unwanted phone calls, calls from people or robots, we don't know, trying to sell us stuff we don't need or want, or to just mislead us in some way. And today, if you're like me, you probably get random calls from random phone numbers all day, every day. So I decided to record some of these anonymous phone calls and put them into a brand new segment I like to call
Anonymous Phone Calls with Dim Tillard.
Who are you?
Who are you?
What do you want?
Who is this?
What do you want?
It's not that simple.
What do you want? What do you want?
Who is this? What's your operating number?
Hello?
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. I'm calling from the United States Census Department for the 2020 census. Am I speaking with Tim?
Yeah, this is Tim.
This survey is required by law and can be completed over the telephone. Do you have a few minutes to talk?
I mean, not really. I was about to...
Great. Let's begin.
Wait, are you even a human?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Are you even a human being?
Interesting.
Are you a human?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, you sound like a robot. Did you know that?
Great. Let's begin.
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
How many people are currently living at your residence?
Five.
Please press the button on the telephone indicating the number of people living at your residence.
Got it. Sorry, hold on.
Have you lived at your residence for more than 3 years?
Yeah. Yeah, we've been here over 3 years.
Please press 1 for no.
All right.
Press 2 for yes. Please type in your social security number.
My social security number? All right, hold on. There you go.
Please type it again for confirmation.
Fine. Here. All right.
Is anyone in your household of Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish origin?
Let's see.
How would you classify your race or origin? American Indian or Alaska Native? Black or African American? Chinese, Filipino, Asian, Indian, Vietnamese, Korean, Japanese, Other Asian, Hawaiian Native, Samoan, Chamorro, Other Pacific Islander, White, or some other race?
I'm white.
You chose Hawaiian Native.
That's not what I said.
Great. Just a few more questions.
That's not what I said. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't catch that.
The last question. You got it wrong. I didn't.
Oh, would you like me to go back?
Yeah. Thank you.
No problem, Tim. How many people are currently living at your residence?
Ah, geez. Not sure what was wrong with that guy. He seemed a little off. My next segment is simple. It's just me telling a story that is somehow tethered to one of my many seasons in professional baseball. Last episode was a story from 2011, and now it's time for 2012. That's right. Here comes the segment appropriately called
Storytime with Dim Tillard.
Listen up. This will only take a second.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
The year was 2012. Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes broke up. Gangnam Style was a song or a dance or something. You remember the Encyclopedia Britannica? Yeah, well, in 2012, the Encyclopedia Britannica stopped making the Encyclopedia Britannica. So, let's see. Eminem turned 40. The Avengers battled The Dark Knight Rises at the box office.
Do you feel in charge?
Skyfall came out and instantly became one of the best Bond movies ever. I think the Olympics were in London. And then there was me, a pitcher in the Milwaukee Brewers organization. And I actually made the big league team out of spring training that year for the first time and only time ever in my career. So that was good. But this isn't a baseball story. This is a Star Wars story. May 3rd, 2012. The Brewers had an off day in San Francisco, California.
California.
California is California.
California.
The state of California.
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 But instead of going to the movies and eating, you know, a lot of candy and then popping by Taco Bell like I do most off days, instead, I went with Major League veteran Randy Wolf, left-handed pitcher, teammate, on a tour of secluded, close to the public, Skywalker Ranch, home of Star Wars, located just across the Golden Gate Bridge outside of San Francisco. That's right, California.
California.
California is California.
California.
The state of California.
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 California is California.
If you're unfamiliar or don't care about Skywalker Ranch, that's understandable. But this is where they do sound and special effects for all the Marvel movies, Harry Potter movies, Mission Impossible movies, pretty much any, you know, big blockbuster movie is done here. This is where Pixar was created, all the Pixar movies. It also has a winery on the premises, as well as Ewok Lake, a main house that's three stories high and like an acre in size. It has its own fire department. And of course, the archives. And we visited and explored it all, except for the main house, which had fire damage because the week before we got there, actor-producer Seth Green was staying there doing work on Robot Chicken and Family Guy and lost control of the fireplace in his room, and so it was closed. But by far, the coolest thing ever was the archives. It's where they keep all the movie props and costumes from Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And even Willow, if you remember the movie Willow. I mean everything. I touched the Death Star, Luke Skywalker's lightsaber, Indiana Jones's man purse.
It's not a man purse. It's called a satchel.
I wore Darth Vader's helmet, a stormtrooper helmet. I petted Chewbacca. I took a picture of the Ark of the Covenant. I didn't want to touch it, so I just stayed clear of that. I twirled Han Solo's blaster. I saw Han Solo frozen to carbonite and even held hands with Boba Fett. It was great. I mean, dream come true for a Star Wars fan like me. I asked a Skywalker Ranch employee, one of the people doing the curating for these archives, you know, all these props and stuff. And I asked her, how many behind the scenes tours do they give? And she said maybe three a year. And also said that the last person that came on a tour before us was Robin Williams. I said, no way. You mean
Euphigenia Doubtfire, dear?
We saw masks and creatures and weapons. I even tried to wear Sean Connery's fake facial hair that he used in Indiana Jones and Last Crusade. We watched original Jabba the Hutt footage on an old film reel and was privileged to many of the film's movie magic secrets. For instance, in the very first Star Wars from 1977, R2-D2 and C-3PO, they didn't escape in an escape pod. They escaped capture inside of a poorly painted original KFC bucket. It, I mean, didn't have chicken in it. Honestly, I'm tearing up just thinking about it.
And that was the greatest day of my whole life.
What about when I was born?
Not even close.
All right, that was sort of fun. Moving right along to something a little more interesting. This week's special guest is a former Major League Baseball player and minor league baseball coach. Played in the College World Series, worked as a parks and recreation director for a number of years, a longtime sporter of the iconic mustache, and also taught my brothers and me how to drive and also play baseball and basically navigate life. That's right. My special guest is my dad, Steve Dillard. So let's get to know Steve Dillard in this week's edition of
Conversations with Dim Tillard.
Why, the who, what, when, the where, and the how.
Who does number two work for?
Ask me about my...
Is this the most technical thing you've ever done?
Probably is.
Well, you click the link. Everything else is easy.
Yeah, I got you now, I think.
What you been doing today?
Let's see. What did we do today? Mom went and got a haircut. Then I met her at Academy Sports. We bought her some walking shoes. Then we went to Sam's, to Applebee's for lunch. Came home resting.
Sound like you had a nice little Saturday planned.
Maybe Bed Bath & Beyond. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have enough time.
Have you listened to my podcast? I don't think you have. Have you?
Yes, most of them I have. I got Eric Young Jr. the other day.
Yeah. What'd you think of that one?
That was good.
That was good. Told you he's awesome. He gets it.
Yeah.
It's probably because he's second generation baseball player.
Yeah. He's got a little more of an idea, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I have an idea, but people that meet me say I have no idea. Well, I was looking up your stats. I don't know if you ever go to baseball something.com to look up your stats, but if I got this right, you played 11 seasons as a player.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing 21 seasons as a coach, but I don't know.
I don't know.
I do want to start off with one question because it's something I've kind of always wanted to know. Seeing as I grew up playing baseball, been playing professional baseball for a long time now. Jeff and Andy, older brothers, played baseball, played professional baseball. What got you interested in baseball when you were a kid?
I think my dad more than anyone else. You know, it's hard to remember back almost 70 years ago now, but I can remember he started me out with a tennis ball, you know, kind of playing catch, and he'd throw it, bounce it one time, and I'd try to catch it or hit it. And as I got older, he started hitting me ground balls when he'd come home from work, and he'd pitch to us when we played backyard games and stuff. So he had the biggest influence on me as far as the love of baseball, getting started. And he probably didn't know a lot about, you know, some aspects of the game, but he could hit a ground ball and he could play catch, and he put in the time. You know, I think that's where a lot of dads are lacking now, you know, being involved in park and rec for all these years I was in there, that parents just kind of want to bring their kid and send them out there, and that's it for them. You know, they don't do anything at home the other days of the week when they're not at park and rec practice. So I got to give my dad the most credit of anyone for the time I got to spend in professional baseball, because he got me started and put in the time when he had a full-time job and coming home after a long day, and never pushed me. He'd wait till I asked. And I said, Dad, you want to hit me some ground balls? He said, I'll be down there in a minute. You go on down there. He'd come on out, hit ground balls till it got dark. Nice. You can't remember when you were a kid. When I'd come home from in Sarasota and it'd be smoking hot all day, but out there in the sun, Mom said I'd come home and sit on the couch and have all three of y'all crawling all over me wanting to go out in the backyard and play. And I said, just give me a minute. Let me kind of cool off. And I'd think about my dad, you know, how much time he spent with me. And I'd say, okay, let's go. And we'd go out there and get us a little work in the backyard.
Yeah. Yeah, I never felt like you pushed us for playing just baseball. I felt like we always had soccer balls around or frisbees or basketball or anything else, football, anything that was around. I feel like we had every piece of sporting equipment. I feel like that's what we had. The garage growing up was like a played against sports.
Pretty much. That's right.
But you did happen to know a little bit about baseball, so naturally we're going to gravitate that way. When did you know? Is there a moment when you knew that you were good? Like, did something happen on the field, maybe in high school, or did somebody come up to you, or a scout, or something like that, and you're like, wow, I never really thought about playing in the big leagues, but then now I feel like I can?
Well, I think I always wanted to from the time I can remember. growing up, that was my goal in life, was to play Major League Baseball. But probably in American Legion, we won state in American Legion. And that following year, my senior year, we won state in baseball in high school. I guess during that time, and then getting a scholarship to Ole Miss and drafted by the Padres and as a senior in high school. And I guess somewhere around that time, I thought, well, man, I may have a chance to do this. I was never really that confident that I could play in the major leagues. I knew I wanted to, but I didn't know how I compared to, you know, players from other parts of the country. But I think winning the American Legion and winning state in baseball and then going to Ole Miss and struggling through a freshman year, the team-wise, I led the team in hitting as a freshman. I don't think that had been done before. And that's when freshmen really – not many freshmen at that time were playing varsity. And then the next year we went to the College World Series and I was drafted. So the more exposure, I guess, you can get, the better. I played in Liberal, Kansas during the summer between my freshman and sophomore year. And that's heavily scouted, that league out there. So
you went to Ole Miss to play shortstop, right? Who played shortstop before you?
Archie Manning played – I don't know if he played 2 or 3 years there. He didn't play his senior year. He was a senior when I was a freshman. And by that time, you know, he was going to play football with New Orleans Saints. So he didn't play his senior year, but he was the shortstop the year before. So I would have loved to have played with Archie a year.
Yeah.
I might have had to play a different position for freshman year, but I think that would have been a lot of fun to get to play with him. Those guys that, you know, were grade or two ahead of me played with Archie and talked about what a great person he was. And of course, we all know how great he was in football, but he was drafted in baseball. So he was a pretty good baseball player, I think.
He was drafted in baseball, too?
I think so. I think the White Sox drafted Archie.
Wow. What about basketball? Because Dave Winfield – didn't Dave Winfield go first round in three sports?
Three or four, I think.
Golly. I can't wait till I go first round in something.
Yeah, I saw your tweet about the draft.
But it's true, though. That's what's sad about it. It's true. Nowadays, it's like they have a whole show devoted to the draft, and – It's funny how they do it. You probably found out you were drafted by what? Carrier pigeon or something? I'm kidding.
I think at that time we might have been at the College World Series. I can't remember. That's when we found out, or right before that. It was during the playoffs anyway. You didn't have cell phones then, and who knows where I was, but somehow I found out. I really don't remember how.
And I found out through the World Wide Web. So college season ends, and you go off with the Red Sox. Where's the first place you report?
Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Went there in July and played that season, then went back there and played a full season the next year. That was their high A club at the time. And
Do you think that's probably the toughest year? Because, I mean, you went on to coach for so long and saw a bunch of minor league guys coming in early. Because I felt like my hardest year was my first full season in pro ball, where I just got to be a part of that 140 games. But guys coming out of college have already played 40 or 50 games, and now they're coming in playing 100 or so games. Is that the hardest season for a player a lot of times?
I would say it probably is, because, you know, you're not used to playing that many games, and you're playing every day. I can remember an A-ball in the Carolinas when it's so hot and humid. It's like it is here in Mississippi. And, man, we'd see a little cloud in the sky, and we're all praying for rain. We don't care if we got to play a doubleheader the next day, but just a day off to get some rest. You didn't have any days off, and I can remember back then. They've got rules now, but I don't remember, you know, having hardly any days off. And playing in that heat, you know, the bus we had, half the time, it, you know, air conditioning didn't work on it. So it's like playing in a sauna. And you just, man, if you can get a day off and just kind of kick back and do nothing, that was great.
Yeah, that's when I heard about the rain turtle. If you carved a turtle into the warning track and everybody spit in it, spit in this little turtle shell, it brought rain. But we did that all the time, and it never worked. So,
you know, the thing on Bull Durham, is it Bull Durham where they put the hose on the field the night before? I think that was done that season when I was in the Carolina League somewhere. I don't remember which field it happened on.
Kevin Costner came out and flooded your baseball field. What a guy.
So that wasn't the first time that happened on Bull Durham. It happened. I'm pretty sure it happened that year.
So you're saying Bull Durham was pretty accurate for the time?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You know, he was a veteran catcher, and only reason they brought him there, you know, was to get that hot shot pitcher to the big leagues. And I think things like that were done. You know, when I was coaching, managing and stuff, we'd talk about we need a staff saver on this pitching staff, you know, an older guy who can soak up innings and you don't worry, you know, you're not, he's not a prospect, but he's a valuable player, you know, to save your young pitchers and stuff. So I think some of those things are, you know, definitely were part of baseball for years and years.
I mean, that's pretty much my whole career. Not a prospect, just I'm more of a suspect or a no spec.
Well, you kind of go through that cycle, don't you? You might start out as a prospect and then you end up being a suspect, I guess.
Let's fast forward. You get to Pawtucket in AAA and then eventually called up to the big leagues. What year was the big leagues? 75-ish?
75. Let's see. That year, I started in AAA. I had shoulder surgery. And the DH at that time, I can't remember exactly what the details were with that, but Tony Conigliaro, who had been beamed and was out of baseball for quite a while, came back with the Red Sox to play, and they sent him to AAA, and he was the DH, so they really wanted to place the DH, I think was the situation. So they sent me to AA about the middle of the year to DH down there, and I finished the season. I ended up playing second base some at the end of the year after having that surgery, and actually had come home for a week or two, and then went to Instructional League in Sarasota. While I was in Instructional League, they called me up. And the reason they called me up at that time, September of 75, the Red Sox were in a pennant race, and Jim Rice had been hit by a pitch, and he was out for the rest of the season, and they just thought they might need a body there to pinch run down the stretch or fill in. So they brought me up for the last couple of weeks of the season, I guess. I wasn't up there very long. But the Red Sox won the pennant, and they clinched it on the next to last day. And I hadn't been in a game yet, but I played the last game.
They waited till they clinched and then they ran you out there.
Went out there and got two hits first two times up, two for five for the day and for the season. So that was probably my best year in the game right there. 400. When I got called up, and Boston was in New York playing the Yankees. But that year, Yankee Stadium was being renovated and the Yankees were playing at Shea Stadium, the Mets home field. So that's where I ended up going when I flew up there. And I had no idea. I'd never been to New York except to drive through, I guess, when I was in the minor leagues. And I got a taxi to the ballpark, and Shea Stadium was round. You know, you couldn't, looking at it, you couldn't tell, I couldn't, where the front gate was. But I just saw an open gate, and I said, hey, let me out right here. And I got a big baseball bag, my regular suitcase, you know, and I lugged that out, and I walked through the gate, and I'm in center field. Thinking, I got a ways to go here. Well, Louis Tiant was out doing his running. I think he must have pitched the night before, and he came out early and doing his running, and he saw me and, you know, knew me from spring training, and came over and carried one of my bags for me into the clubhouse.
Did he really?
Wow. Which was, you know, here, you know, I'm a rookie, and he's by that time, you know, he'd been playing probably 15 years in the big leagues.
Yeah.
And, but just, he was a super guy. You know, I enjoyed playing with him as much as anybody that I ever played with. But he carried my suitcase for me into the clubhouse, and like I said, I didn't play until it was almost a week later, I guess. I was only up there a week or so.
Yep.
Didn't play until the last game of the year. But the first game I saw, or it was actually, I guess, a part of, watching it from the dugout, was Shea Stadium, Yankees and Red Sox.
I wonder how many people can say that.
Or how many people get called up to the big leagues from Instructional League. I don't know if that's ever been done.
And you're a trivia answer somewhere.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So the next year rolls around. Did you make the team at the spring training?
Yeah. Next spring, I made the team as utility infielder. And I was up there all year until I got sent down for the month of August to play strictly second base because they were looking at me as maybe going to be their second baseman for the future. And I've been playing second, short, and third in Boston. So they sent me down. I played at Pawtucket for a month and came back up for September. I guess the craziest thing that happened that season was that was when the Oakland A's, Charlie Finley, he was going to sell his team. But before he sold his team, he was going to sell all the players. Make a little more money doing that. So
fire sale.
Yeah. Let's see. Had Vita Blue, Raleigh Fingers. And the left fielder, golly, great player, Joe Rudy. Those were the three players that he, right at the trade deadline, he was working out trades. And the Red Sox picked up Joe Rudy, and it was a pitcher. I can't remember. It was Raleigh Fingers. Anyway, they weren't there. But the commissioner overruled the deal after just a few days, and I was. They had to make room, so I was the player. One of the players that got sent down to make room for those two guys. I got sent down to Pawtucket, and we were on the West Coast when that happened. We were in Oakland, and the commissioner, Bowie Kuhn, overruled that deal in just a few days. So I was only in Pawtucket 3 or 4 days and got called back up. The team by that time was in Anaheim, so kind of zoomed across country. But after that game, we got back on a Sunday and played a Sunday day game. And after that game in Anaheim, we flew across country to Baltimore. So I think your mom would probably tell me. I probably didn't know where I was there for several days going back.
Yeah, that's one thing about baseball people don't realize. I mean, there's a lot of traveling involved. Doesn't matter how successful you are. You can be in the minor leagues on a bus going across state lines, or you can be on a plane going coast to coast. If you're not cut out for the road, I mean, it's a tough life.
You got to learn how to handle that, don't you? You got to learn how to ride a bus in the minor leagues and planes in the big leagues and be able to get rest. I mean, I could go to sleep on a plane before it left the ground most of the time.
I know. You can fall asleep while I'm having a conversation with you. That's why I told Mom to have like a stick in case you start dozing off during my podcast.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. All right. Where are we at? 76.
Yeah.
They go to the playoffs. Did you make the playoff roster in 76?
No, I didn't. I got to watch it on TV, just like everybody else. You know, Pudge Fisk home run in game 6 and all that. I was in the instructional league down in Sarasota.
Enough instructional league. Don't you have enough instruction?
Yeah. I had 3 years of that.
I think I did it once. They were like, "Nah, you're perfect. You know everything now, so you go ahead." Well, what year did you go to Venezuela? What offseason was that?
I think that was the year between 76 and 77 season. I believe okay. That's right. The Red Sox thought
you needed more instruction?
Yeah, they wanted me to go down there and play. So I went down and played until New Year's Eve, I think. Mom and I came home, left 85 degree weather, whatever it was down here, and got to Tupelo, and it was about 30 degrees.
Let me see. What else can I ask you? Where are we? We're 19.
The year before your oldest brother was born, I guess.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all. One thing I thought was interesting is that since I've played in the big leagues, and I've played at all the three remaining stadiums that you've played at, Fenway, Wrigley, Dodger Stadium, I've always wondered, what stadium did you play at that you love the most?
Oh, I don't know. My favorite stadiums were Fenway and Wrigley. You know, being the home stadium, that was even better. But I didn't miss Candlestick Park at all. Glad to see that place is gone. Freeze to death in July out there. I don't know of any of the other stadiums. Yankee Stadium, you know, was a cool place to go. I was grew up a Yankee fan and, you know, really followed them all my life. So
I didn't know you grew up a Yankees fan. Probably time to move on. Let's go to the Tigers, 1978. Go.
I got traded to Detroit, and their second baseman they had the year before, I think they released him, so it kind of seemed like it was wide open, you know. I thought I'd have a good opportunity. I did have an opportunity, but I didn't know at the time who Lou Whitaker was or Alan Trammell, you know, and those two guys were like 18 and 19 years old. And I got platooned a little while there with Lou at second base. I think Trammell was platooned with another player at short some. And then, you know, after a month, it was obvious how good those guys were.
Yeah.
So, you know, they ended up playing together for 18 years, I think. Set a record for a double play combination. And so that was kind of a lost year, really, except for Jeff being born, I guess. That was about the highlight of that year.
Yeah. You became a dad that year, but that was a lost year. Yeah. He doesn't listen to the podcast, so you're good.
That's good.
Yeah. Can't wait for Christmas. All right. So you got traded to the Cubs?
Yeah. During spring training the next spring. I got traded and about the middle of spring training, I guess. So Mom and I were in Lakeland, Florida, and we drove home to Mississippi, and I left her here, and I flew to Arizona for the last couple of 3 weeks of spring training, you know, just assuming I was going to be on a major league team. And I got out there, the player that you were named after, Tim Blackwell, was a catcher with the Cubs, and had been together with the Red Sox. Now we ended up with the Cubs. And I remember Tim telling me, you know, you may not have this team made, because he'd been there, you know, the whole spring. I said, really? He says, no. I thought it'd be just kind of an automatic thing because I'd been in the big leagues for 3 years at that time, I guess.
Yeah.
So I had to have – I had a pretty decent spring, ended up making the team, and then, you know, playing for the Cubs for the next 3 years. But it's always different when you go to a new team. It helped out knowing Blackwell, but he was, I think, the only guy I really knew at the time. But really enjoyed playing for the Cubs, too. That's a great, great city and fan base and all that. That was really a good time.
Yeah, Tim Blackwell, I mean, that guy's – what a name. What a name.
Yeah.
So who – you guys were friends for so – you know, dating back so long. We're families. Our families are friends. Who had their mustache first, you or Tim? Because you guys
both
had epic mustaches.
I don't know. I can't remember. If first time we met was in A-ball when I first signed the contract with the Red Sox. He was my first roommate, but I cannot remember. I don't think I had a mustache at the time. I don't know. I can't remember who got it first. That's a good question. We'll have to get together and talk about that with Tim.
Yeah. I tried it. I tried to find it on Google, and Google didn't have it. That's how obscure it is. But, yeah, there was a time when I wouldn't even be able to recognize you if you didn't have a mustache.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Looking back on your career, and it can be any point in your career, let's say your truck, right? Is your truck out of the shop? Did you get your truck back?
Yeah, it's running good.
All right. Let's say it can get up to 88 miles an hour, and it can take you back in time to a certain game or a certain moment in your career. What day you go into? What game you go into? Where you at?
Oh, goodness. Well, the best run I had in my career was in August of 79 with the Cubs. And for about 2 weeks, just everything went great. I think I hit 5 home runs, which I didn't have any all year. That was the only home runs I hit the whole season. It was all in a span of about 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And I got National League Player of the Week and Cubs Player of the Month for that month of August. So I guess it would be the middle of August of 1979. I don't know. Things just clicked. And I remember years later talking to some great players that I was coaching with. One of them was Cesar Cedeno. And I was telling him about that. I said, you know, I wasn't that good a player, but I was a utility player. But, man, for 2 or 3 weeks, just everything, I hit the ball hard, all fields, hit home runs. And, you know, just the ball looked big, I guess, like you hear hitters talk about. And I said, do you have experience like that? And he said, oh, yeah, I have runs like that would last for months. Wow. So I guess that's the difference between being an ordinary player and being a great player. These guys just – it just goes on and on and on with them. But for me, it was about 2 or 3 weeks, and I was kind of back to normal after that. that's baseball, and that's the way it works out.
That's what's the attraction of it. There's no rhyme or reason at times, and you have to be okay with that.
You know, I can remember guys talking about that when I first – got in the game, you know, in professional baseball, you got to be able to handle the downs. I mean, everybody, it's pretty easy to handle when things are going good, but when you're going, when things are not going good and hanging in there and trying to have the right attitude and approach and all that, that's the tough part.
A moment in your life when it got really tough. 1983, I was born.
Yeah.
So, but before that, right before that, you had your last taste of the big leagues, right? 1982,
yeah.
White Sox.
Yeah, I'd gotten released by the Cubs after the 81 season. That was when they sort of cleaned the house there, management, players, and everything. And Roland Heeman was the GM of the White Sox, and he was willing to give me a contract, minor league contract, and invite it to big league camp with an opportunity to try to make the staff as a utility player. Tony La Russa was a manager, and I think they had three of us that were kind of three veteran guys that were kind of fighting for the utility role. And it came down to they released one of those guys, traded one of them. They sent me to AAA. So they didn't keep any of us. But we spent the season in Edmonton, Alberta. And then I had the best year of my life there overall. I mean, playing every day, which I hadn't done since, goodness, going way back, you know, 73, I guess, and first full season where I played 140-something games. But I hit over 300 and had a great year, and I thought I'd get called up and didn't at first. And then the White Sox had an injury, so I got called back up for the last couple of weeks of the season that went up. So I was with Tony La Russa, and Carlton Fisk had been traded by that time, and he was on the team. So that was a, you know, good way to finish. And after that is when I got into managing for the White Sox.
So let me ask you this. Who – and you've kind of alluded to it a little bit. You've brought up several names. Who was your favorite teammate?
Well, I guess it'd be hard to pick a favorite, but Louis Tiant, he was just a real popular guy, you know, with the Red Sox. And by this time, you know, I guess I didn't see him early in his career live. I probably saw him on TV some, but he was a fireballer. You know, he and Sam McDowell with the Indians were – they were about two of the hardest throwers in the game at that time. And by this time, Louis had had some arm trouble and didn't throw that hard anymore. But he had an assortment of pitches, and he had that windup you've probably seen where he turned his back to the hitter and all kinds of misdirection kind of stuff and just competed. You know, that's the thing that was impressive about him. He just went out and competed, and you loved to play behind him. And then just a natural player out all around with Fred Lynn. You know, I played in the minor leagues with Fred and Jim Rice, and Fred just all around, you know, defensive player, knew how to, he was a good base runner and a great hitter, and made, you know, MVP and Rookie of the Year his first full year in the big leagues. And Jim Rice, you know, was a great hitter. So Carlton Fisk, Carl Yastrzemski, just so many great players. So it'd be hard to pick favorite teammate. It's hard, you know, because Tim Blackwell is such a good friend. I guess I'd have to say Tim is probably my favorite of all time.
Otherwise, my name would be Louie. That'd be Louie Tiant Dillard.
Another guy that I played with, too, who fans would probably remember is Mark Fidrich, the Bird. Hmm. I think he was a rookie in 76, had a great year, then 77, had some injuries. By the time I played with him in 78, He started a few games that year, but he was pretty much – his career was almost done, I think, with injuries. But I think I played in one game where he pitched a one-hitter or a two-hitter or something, complete game. And he would just – you know, you make a routine play, and he's looking out there shaking his fist at you, great play, great play. And just kept you – you know, you just hit it to me. You know, I want to help this guy. I want to do whatever I can, you know. He had so much fun playing the game. So he was an impressive guy. And just as competitive, too, as like Tiant, you know, his career was cut short, you know, because of injuries.
So it sounds like you played with a lot of Hall of Famers. You ever figure out how many Hall of Famers you played with?
I did that one time, yeah. Seemed like, I don't know, 10 or 11.
Every year it changes, though.
It seems like it. You know, Trammell and Jack Morris from the Tigers got in, and, you know, Tony La Russa as a manager. A lot of those Red Sox guys, you know, Rice and Yastrzemski and Fisk. Bruce Sutter, Lee Smith, I played with the Cubs. So I may be missing somebody. But I think it's about 10 guys maybe.
All right. So I got a question for you. This is a true or false question. True or false. Did you once elbow legendary sports writer Peter Gammons in the eye while playing basketball?
Man, yeah, going back to spring training, one year we had a strike. I guess that's what happened. It's been so many years ago. And we were just down in Winter Haven working out, Red Sox, and we'd go out, just the players, you know, we'd work out a little bit, and there's a armory or something there with a basketball goal and indoors, and we'd play basketball. Every Pete played with us some, and I knew I got him in the mouth, I think, or eye or something with an elbow. Of course, I didn't even know who he was at the time, and he was a young guy, too, but many, many years ago. Yeah, I did get Pete.
I always love that story. Back to your rookie season, you faced Jim Palmer, Hall of Famer. What happened there? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, he struck me out on a call strike. It's about 6 inches inside. And, of course, what are you going to say? You know, he's all-star, and I was a rookie. And the next day, he was out in the outfield doing his running during batting practice, and he ran by me, and he said, "Hey, Rook." I turned, and he says, "When I'm pitching, you got to swing at that pitch." So I didn't never thought about that until about that time, and that kind of became a conversation, you know. Certain pitchers, the good ones, and certain hitters, like I know some of them would say, you know, if Yaz didn't swing at it, you know, they weren't going to call it. I didn't see that as a player. I never realized it that much, but I know some of the other players kind of thought that.
All right. Who is the most menacing pitcher you ever faced? And keep in mind that you never had your chance to face me, so.
Oh. Well, one thing I kind of had to learn when I got to the big leagues, I started getting platooned, especially in Fenway Park, I guess, with what we had there for Denny Doyle was a left-handed hitting second baseman. I got platoon with Denny some. So, you know, when you're growing up, you don't see many left-handed pitchers. You have to learn. You start seeing more of them in the big leagues and in the minor leagues too, I guess. But had to learn how to hit left-handed pitchers. So I became pretty good hitter against left-handed pitchers. I hit a home run off Vida Blue and a couple of home runs in a game off John Candelaria. But one guy that I couldn't do anything with was Steve Carlton. And I never hit a ball hard off him. And I part of that, I thought, was because Tim McCarver was catching. And he's another Southern boy, and he was reading my mind or something. I don't know. But it just seemed like there was no way that I just couldn't get a good swing off Carlson.
Yeah. Okay, let's look a little bit to the coaching side of your career. You had players in the minor leagues that you were managing that you knew were going to be amazing big leaguers. But is there also some minor leaguers that you didn't think had a chance that went on to have a great career?
Oh, there were some guys, I think, that made it to the big leagues that at the time you didn't really think would make it. Of course, I can't remember any of them at my age.
Oh, yeah, those memorable players. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, one guy that wasn't drafted all that high, I don't think, was Matt Carpenter with the Cardinals that I had my last stint coaching and managing. But he was a great player in A-ball and played the game the right way and hustled and was a team player. But I never foresaw that he was going to have the career that he's had. You know, I had Billy Wagner, who had a great career and may have a shot getting into the Hall of Fame at some point.
Yeah.
Ron Karkovice was a catcher with the White Sox. It was one of the best catch and throw guys that I've ever seen. And several other players, I'm sure, if I took time to try to remember.
Yeah, Matt Carpenter, he actually follows me on Twitter. Billy Wagner, I don't know if he follows me on Twitter. I have to look at that.
You kind of drove him nuts when he was playing, didn't you?
Yeah, well, no, I shined his shoes. I charged him 50 cents a shoe.
That's right.
All right, I'll let you go. One last question here, because, you know, you have a track record. Every time I talk to coaches, every time I talk to anybody that you've played with or been with, they always say, yeah, Steve Dillard is a great guy. I tell him I said hello, love being around him. And that's carried over into how you raised us and coached us. So what kind of advice would you give to a parent that's raising athletes? And then what kind of advice would you give to the athlete? Is that too involved of a question?
I think something that you figured out, you know, at some point there, probably in junior college, maybe, that, you know, talent only take you so far. Then you know, as a player, you know, you need to put in the time and what it takes, you know, to get better. And you had some good examples, your older brothers. They were all pretty hard workers, and you turned into a hard worker, I think.
Eventually.
Yeah.
I'll get there. I'll start working hard soon.
And as far as parents, I always thought, you know, let kids play what sport they want to play. And if they don't want to play, don't force them into it. Because I ran Park and Rec here for several years. And even when we lived in Florida, you know, I'd do little baseball camps, you know, during the winter time down there. And there'd be a lot of kids that would show up at those camps. And, you know, they didn't want to be there. You know, mom and dad's making them do it. And I never thought that was a good idea. But sometimes kids maybe need a little push to get them, you know, going in the right direction. But I would say just give them the opportunity and don't be critical. You know, try to be a positive influence rather than, you know, picking out every little thing they did wrong, you know, in the game they just played. And, you know, you see a lot of that. And I think sometimes you turn the players against the game and they just give it up. And you've seen guys like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you came along that just started playing travel ball when they were 3 years old, and by the time they got to junior college, you know, they hated it. So I think you can go overboard with that.
Yeah. So not putting too much emphasis on the game of baseball.
Yeah, I think, you know, let them play everything if they want to play it and see what they like and support them in whatever they want to do.
Well, good, Dad. That was good. Is there anything I didn't cover? We covered your entire career.
I think you did pretty quick.
And what's interesting is that, you know, every time we have some sort of talk over Christmas or I'm visiting for Thanksgiving or whatever's going on, every time we're together, it's like something happens and something's jogged in your memory and you share a story that I still have never heard. And I'm just like, Dad, I've known you, you know, my whole life. How come you've never shared that story? And you're like, oh, I just thought about it.
It is kind of funny how something like that comes up. You know, you'll hear something or somebody will jog your memory. Oh yeah, I forgot about that. But then I don't remember, you know, I can't remember stuff. You read about some of these guys, Ted Williams can remember every pitch.
Yeah.
I can't even remember every year, you know. Game. So I don't know. It's a great game, and I'm glad you're getting an opportunity, and I certainly enjoyed it. And let's try to play some baseball this year. Talk to those folks and tell them to get the stuff figured out so we can start watching baseball. I want to come watch you play.
Yeah, all I need is a phone number of someone to call, and I'll get right on that. Well, Dad, I appreciate you being on my podcast. And
you're welcome, Tim. I enjoyed it.
I love you, Dad.
Hey, well, I thought old Pops McGee did a great job. So much wisdom, so much mustache. Hope you enjoyed it. And that'll do it for this week's episode of the Inner Monologue of Dim Tillard Podcast. If you have questions or comments, please contact me on any of my social media, and I'd be more than happy to respond and get back to you whenever I feel like it. And yes, please take 10 seconds to give a 5-star rating if you're on Apple Podcasts, and also an additional 30 seconds to write a stellar review of this show if you haven't already. And if you're looking for Dim Tillard gifts for the someone in your life that you kind of like or only sort of dislike, go to dimtillard.com and click on Buy My Crap. My sponsors this week are...
I can't find it. The hell with it.
That's it. And thanks again for listening to the number one most unneeded podcast, The Inner Monologue of Dim Tillard.
You were just listening to The Inner Monologue of Dim Tillard.